This is The Reason Interview with Nick Gillespie. Today's episode is sponsored by BetterHelp Online Therapy. More on them later in the show. My guest is journalist Nate Silver, who burst onto the national scene in 2008 when he correctly predicted 49 out of 50 states in that year's election, outstripping all other analysts by a country mile. His former website, 538.com, became a must-visit stop for anyone interested in political forecasting, and it also helped mainstream the concept of data journalism, which utilizes the same sort of hardcore modeling and probabilistic thinking that helped Nate succeed as a professional poker player and as a staffer at the legendary Baseball Prospectus. We talk about the 2024 election, why libertarian defenses of free speech are gaining ground among liberals, his take on the crisis in legacy media, and we also talk about his forthcoming book, On the Edge. This was taped live at an event that we call the Little Singer Series, which is held monthly in New York, live events of heterodox thinking with strong commitments to free speech and open expression. Here is the Reason interview with Nate Silver. So welcome, Nate Silver.
Thank you, Nick. Thank you, everybody.
So I want to start with a discussion of your recent essay at your Substack, which is called the Silver Bulletin.
Just Silver Bulletin.
Silver Bulletin. Yeah. You put a lot of work into that title, didn't you?
No, it was like I took about 3 seconds doing it, and now it has like some brand equity, for better or worse.
Yeah.
So I'm afraid to change it.
So you're like Allen Ginsberg, first thought, best thought?
No, but I don't know. Like now it's kind of hokey and stupid. And I kind of like that. It's like kind of unpretentious, right? I mean, I've workshopped internally like better names if you're like some corporate branding consultant you'd prefer. But like I kind of like the cheesiness of it.
Well, it's working. And on November 8th, I think it was, you had a fantastic discussion where you used Friedrich Hayek's libertarian cri de coeur, Why I'm Not a Conservative, to talk about a kind of crack up on the left side of the political spectrum. Hayek wrote Why I'm Not a Conservative as a postscript to Constitution of Liberty. And in it, he talked about how in America, the terms conservative and liberal didn't quite make sense the way they did in a European context. Because classical liberals or libertarians over there were often, or in America, were coded as conservatives. Whereas they in fact were quite liberals in a European context. We're pretty revolutionary and radical and a constant critique of what's going on. And that liberals and libertarians then in an American context, libertarians' natural enemy was were actually socialists who were sometimes called liberals in an American context. But both liberals, and now I'm not even sure I know what I'm saying, liberals, libertarians, and socialists' real enemy were conservatives. So with that as a backdrop, you wrote... let me just get here. You applied that Hayekian framework to contemporary U.S. politics after the October 7th attacks on Israel in your piece, which was titled Why Liberalism and Leftism Are Increasingly at Odds. The Progressive Coalition is Splitting Over Israel and Identity Politics. Talk about that. Like, what does the response on campus and in certain political precincts tell us about what's going on in the left side of American politics?
I mean, there are a lot of dimensions to it. One thing I actually did internally that helped is I actually asked our friend ChatGPT, not the woke one, not Google Gemini, right? But like, define liberalism, leftism, progressivism, libertarianism, and wokeism, which is a term that is not in as common use as those others, right? And if you break that down issue by issue, you kind of realize that actually, if you're really teasing out, because what ChatGPT does is figure out like, how is this term used in writing the consensus of all writing on the internet, right? And like actually liberalism is kind of closer to libertarianism than it is to certainly to like leftism or to like more woke modern variants of that.
Why did it take an event like, like the October 7th attacks to kind of make that visible?
I'm not sure. Look, I am someone who went to the University of Chicago and London School of Economics, and I took all the European Enlightenment history classes, right, and read like a lot of political philosophy. So like, to me, it's like always been like rattling around in the back of my head. And I think journalists should take more political philosophy classes, right? I mean, these ideas remain very important and very pertinent to many debates that we're having today. But no, it's like partly like, I mean, look, if you write a Substack, then it's not all, it might seem off the cuff, but like you always have like a lot of ideas rattling around in your head, right? And so kind of I had like half drafted versions of this post and like an event like October 7th. Look, I'm not super like polarized on Israel or anything like that, right? But like you have a news hook, you have a moment, which is kind of an emperor has no clothes moment where like these university presidents are so clearly out of touch with kind of the American mainstream. And people feel like they have permission to kind of say this now after holding their tongue in a lot of previous events. So it's like, it's a news peg or a news hook about things that I think a lot of people had observed for a long time, which is the kind of Hayek triangle, right? Between, you know, what I call liberalism, but you can call it classical liberalism or libertarianism, and then kind of what was socialism, but not, might be now kind of more social justice leftism. And then, you know, what was conservatism, but is now more like MAGA-fied, particularly illiberal conservatism, right?
And so is the, in this version of things, is progressivism or wokeism or identity politics, is it socialism minus economics, and then you're left with identity politics, or what's the defining attribute of that cluster?
No, that, I mean, I think, you know, reorienting the leftist critique around issues having to do with identity, particularly race and gender, obviously, as opposed to class, I think is interesting, right? And again, I don't get into like every detail of every debate, but like when you have like the New York Times, the 1619 Project, right? The traditional like crusty socialists didn't like that very much, right? That was a sign, she says, an anthropologist about like how even like leftism and like kind of the new form of leftism are different, I think, in important respects, right?
Where, you know, where are conservatives on this? Because you talked about conservatives. I guess if there's a crack up on the left between what might have been called liberals, you know, for lack of a better term, and progressives, there's MAGA on the right, and then is there, you know, what's the non-MAGA right, and is that analogous to what's going on the left?
I mean, look, as you point out earlier, and as Hayek points out, right, America's weird in that we were kind of the first country founded in, like, Enlightenment values, right? So things like the rule of law and free speech and individualism, right? The market economy is something that comes along right at this time, right? The Industrial Revolution and the Enlightenment are very closely tied together historically. And so if you are appealing to, like, traditional American values, you're appealing to values that are, like, fairly lowercase L libertarian, right? Certainly are kind of liberal values, right? Mitt Romney, a Republican, says he likes liberal democracy and uses that term, I think, correctly, like people should, right? And so, like, so it is weird in that they are, like, traditional American values. You know, look, I'm not a fan of, I don't want to endorse candidates. I'm not a fan of, like, almost anything about Donald Trump, right? I don't think it's the most constructive form of conservatism. And, like, you know, and also, like, I do believe in progress and technological and societal and economic progress. I think it's very important. It feels like kind of there aren't very many people who do believe in progress anymore, right? Like, one of the fundamental factors in all of world history is that, like, for many, many centuries, millennia, human GDP grew at, like, 0.1% per year, right? You kept up with population growth barely, if that, right? The beginning of the late 18th century, there was a takeoff toward growth, right? And that coincided with both the Enlightenment and the Industrial Revolution, which came first is a big debate in economic history. But there was progress when there hadn't been before, and like people don't know that basic history.
Yeah, what do you think happened? I mean, I feel like in my lifetime, or even just in the 21st century, the idea of progress or the acknowledgement of progress that, you know what, every day, you know, every year, our cars get a little bit better, our phones transform from something that was plugged into the wall to something you carry around in your pocket. Yeah. You know, everything is getting better. We are in kind of a dank mode right now, right? Where people on the right and the left are kind of like, maybe we have material progress, but everything else is terrible, or we don't even have that. What's driving that?
No, look, there are, I think, good data-driven arguments for secular stagnation, right?
And can you define that?
So, I mean, the way it's used informally is to mean that progress is slowing down or maybe not really happening very much at all, or that there are a lot of headwinds, right? There's like a more Larry Summers technical definition. But look, you know, GDP in the Western world grows now at like 1.5% per year, whereas it peaked at like 3.5% in the 1960s, for example. Life expectancy in the U.S. has stagnated. That's not very good. IQ is a contentious topic, but IQ has stagnated. Mental well-being has declined by various measures, right? Mm-hmm. You know, many European countries have not seen their economy grow substantially in many years. There is lower fertility around the world, which I think is something that people, you know, the left doesn't like to talk about, but is a certainly an important dimension of, like, you know, political dysfunction is on the rise, right? So, like, I think that thesis is actually fairly well constructed in some ways, right? But like the constant doomerism on all sides. I mean, if you have like the kind of political quadrant, right, where like the green, whatever, libertarian on social issues, right, everybody has like something they're deeply worried about, right?
Right.
A certain type of person thinks that like AI is going to like destroy the world, which, by the way, I take somewhat seriously. That's a different debate, right?
Yeah.
I had dinner with a group last night, and they're like, well, you know, why would you bring children to this world because of climate change, right? And like, that's, I think that view is wrong, but it's like,
well, to
very
punish
common
them,
on the left,
right?
Yeah.
You know, to punish them.
Oh, yeah, okay, yeah, of course.
Well, you know, I mean, why not? So who asked to be born?
We suffered, other people should too.
I think so. How do you think these intra-ideological issues, you know, on the right, the left, and obviously that's not, particularly among libertarians, this is, you know, we don't want to talk about a right-left spectrum because it tends to leave us out, but how do you think the breakup on the left and on the right is going to play out in the election season coming up?
I mean, one thing in the short term Democrats have going for them is that Trump kind of unites both the liberals and the left, right? Like that left/liberal coalition, which kind of partly formed under Obama in 2008, in part because people were sick of Bush, right? Kind of carried forward unsuccessfully with Clinton in 2012 and then, or 2016 rather, and then Biden successfully in 2020. Trump really unites people that would otherwise be at loggerheads over many issues. But this time I'm not sure, right? I mean, again, I am not trying to like articulate an editorial position on Israel Gaza stuff, right? But if you have terms that are being tossed around like genocide, again, I'm not editorial, I'm just saying like that's a sign, people use those terms, they're very serious, right? That's not in the bluffing stage of, oh, maybe I won't vote for Biden, who, by the way, is 81 years old, right, and has been, I think, kind of somewhat.
But, you know, he presents as like 79 or 80, so.
Yeah. Yeah. No, it's like, okay, yeah, he's doing above average for an 81-year-old. Okay, I don't really want like a 78-year-old president either, right?
Yeah. So what do you think? I mean, you know, Gallup, which has been doing, a self-identification of political party for decades, is now showing it's something like the last one was 27% of people say they're Republicans. 27% say they're Democrats, which I think is their historic low, or right near it, and then about the rest are independent. A guy out there in the audience, Matt Welch, and I wrote a book called The Declaration of Independence merely a dozen years ago. It's still available for purchase in used bookstores and garages everywhere across America. But, I mean, are we finally seeing a kind of breakdown, not of the two-party system, because it's always going to be two parties, but the way that Republicans and Democrats talk about the constellation of issues that define them. Is this the end of the road for that iteration?
I mean, I think when the end comes, it will come maybe more quickly than people think, but I wouldn't bet on it happening in like the next 5 or 10 years, right? I mean, in some ways, the parties have become more efficient about building their electoral coalition. It's kind of a remarkable fact that in American politics, each party gets about half the vote. If you get like 48% versus 52%. It's like considered almost a landslide these days.
And it's amazing. I mean, according to, and if these analyses are wrong, explain why. But in 2016, it was about 80,000 votes across three states that changed. And it was about 40,000 votes across three states in 2020.
Well, in a country of 300 billion, million people, right? It's remarkable that elections are that close, right?
Yeah.
It has to do with the efficiency in some ways of the political system.
Right.
But they do it by enforcing more and more orthodoxy, right? There's no a priori reason why your view on taxation and abortion and Gaza and marijuana legalization and 10 other issues needs to be tied together. But you kind of flatten out this multidimensional space into two parties. One difference now versus a couple decades ago is that the public intellectuals, or maybe it's too generous a term, right? But like the pundits are more partisan than the voters. They're the ones who enforce partisan orthodoxy. And if you're somebody who, look, I'm basically a good center-left liberal, right? In most rooms, I feel, in some rooms in New York, I feel like I'm the more conservative person, but in this room, probably like one of the most, you know, woke people, probably.
You're practically a stooge of the Soviet Union here.
Yeah, exactly.
I suspect, yeah.
But if you kind of break from orthodoxy, there's a very efficient policing of of people who piss inside the tent and and dissent from the coalition and have the credibility to say that out loud, right? Because you can influence people if you're willing to like just speak your mind. I mean, it helps to be established where you're not really afraid of anything.
In a way, I mean, if the political parties are becoming more kind of orthodox and kind of enforcing, and you know, they may be losing popular support, but that doesn't really matter in a two-party system because one of them is going to win. But how does that, you know, if political parties and identities are kind of whimpering to an end, that also seems true of legacy media. And by legacy media, I mean, I guess corporate media or like big media from a few years ago, which all of which seems to be kind of fumbling over itself. A couple weeks ago, we saw an outpouring of anger that Vice magazine, which up until about 2 weeks ago had been seen as a charnel house of sexual harassment. Suddenly, when it goes bankrupt, then people are like, I can't believe we lost this, you know, the last outpost of great journalism, right? And other things like that happened, you know, when Sports Illustrated finally went belly up. The LA Times, a newspaper that literally nobody read, went, you know, is cutting off, you know, cutting staff. What's going on with the legacy media, and is that in any way tied to what's going on in the political identity space?
No, look, in an effort to be kind of nuanced and textured, I think it's 80% secular economic forces where you had this advertising bundle that was very powerful and that like kind of probably, you know, wasn't like a natural occurrence per se. It was like kind of a form of economic rent, more or less, that subsidized the industry. And look, I again, my parents are like, they would walk down to the store and buy the New York Times, even growing up in Michigan and things like that. I respect traditional journalism, but I think it's mostly an economic story. It's hard because, you know, I think journalism does create, in theory, social utility. I'm not sure I think that journalism should be funded by governments, though it is in many countries, right?
When you say you're not sure, do you mean you know it shouldn't be?
I mean,
that's a real question.
Okay, so here's my idea, which I'm stealing from one of my future Substack posts, right? I think universities should run, maybe it's a bad idea. I don't know.
Yeah, immediately, okay. But follow
but like,
it
what
up.
What if like the Harvard, like, come on. What if Harvard, I mean, it sounds like a bad idea.
Yeah.
What if universities bought newspapers, right?
Yeah.
Because like universities are more useful than, or excuse me, newspapers are categorically more useful than academic papers, right? They are.
Well, because they have comic section.
They have comic, yeah. Right?
Yeah.
No, but like, look, they are producing journalism in real time. They're the first draft of history, right? They're read much more widely. The writing is like much, much, much better, right? And so, you know, Harvard should take the fact that members can actually write and communicate with the public and have them write for like the Boston Globe, I think, instead of for
maybe
some obscure
University
journal.
Of Miami or a party school could take over Vice, right?
There you go. Yeah, exactly.
It's a brand extension, for God's sake.
But no, I think it is a secularly bad trend.
Yeah.
Now, if you like,
it's a secularly bad trend that journalism outfits are going out of business, or these
again,
particular ones
being for once like the kind of most left-wing person in the room. Yeah. Look, I think journalism does. I think, look, we could debate for the rest of the night about them, or not debate, agree probably on the many things I think journalists do wrong. I do think it's not great that local journalism has been hit so badly, right? There's also this kind of like, you know, look, I'm a big fan of Substack. I make money from it.
Yeah.
You kind of realize your marginal revenue product a little bit more explicitly. You know, there is always like an implicit deal where like, if you go and like report from like the front lines of Ukraine, like that's not actually going to be narrowly profitable, right? So you always had like subsidization of like enterprise reporting and foreign reporting from cooking and homes, right? And the editorial section, right? Where you pay people pretty well, but like they get lots and lots of clicks or Wordle or whatever, or games. And if like that bundle breaks down, then like, I mean, New York Times itself is doing well.
Do you think that kind of journal, and I was going to quote from the Declaration of Independence, Matt and I wrote about you as emblematic, actually. And, you know, and this is so a dozen years ago. We wrote at one point saying, in the wake of the organization man comes a new breed of individuals such as baseball stats nerds, Nate Silver and Bill James, who created not only highly personalized careers, but even the field in which they work. That had to do with baseball. But then after that, you know, you created 538. And could you walk through kind of the stages of death that went along with that? Because when 538 launched, it was a phenomenal resource that was doing things that other sites weren't doing. And it was, you know, it was interesting and fascinating. And then what it you ended up moving to the New York Times with it and then to ABC Disney.
So we were under license to the New York Times. Right. So basically just like was hired by the Times for 3 years. And then we sold 538. I'm not sure who that we is. I sold 538 to Disney ESPN in 2014, which became was transferred intercompany transferred to ABC News.
And I mean, was it I mean, is 538, which now has ceased publication, right?
There is a version of 538. The people who are still there work hard.
And I'm not saying anything. What I'm saying, though, is like, so within, a little bit more than 10 years, you went from starting something fundamentally new that made a major impact on legacy media, you know, in two giant news organizations.
Yeah.
And now has kind of, you know, is in its Biden years, let's say, right? Where it's taking the afternoons off. And, you know, is that a tragedy or will something else come up? Is it the fact that you could do that was because there's so much more possibility and capacity for new things? I mean, just talk a little bit about that. And you then as the individual behind it, are you better or worse off being at, you know, at Substack for the moment?
I mean, the latter question's easier. So yeah, for me, it's like, I feel much better off. I just kind of have like a little extra like pep in my step being independent again, right? You probably wind up making the same income. It might be from six different sources. So the taxes are more complicated, but it's very nice to have like an incentive, like actually get, if you write a good Substack post, then people subscribe to your blog and you get money in your bank account, right? Like that actually feels like good to have like actual incentives to work hard and to develop an audience. I mean, the problem with ABC News and Disney is that like, it was basically like run like a kind of socialist economy almost, right? Or not, I mean, look, obviously Disney's a well-run business in some ways, but like we were so small relative to their scale that they didn't care one way or the other. If you make 5 million or lose 5 million, why do they care, right? It's like one day of theme park receipts at one theme park somewhere in the world. It's actually really bad though, right? It makes you kind of like a client of the regime, right? That your capacity to stay there depends on the goodwill of people who are able to kind of write off an X million dollar loss a year. Also, like we had good economics for a subscriber business, right? We have loyal, frankly, high net worth readers who have a differentiated willingness to pay. Who had been around 538 for a long time. It could have been a good subscription business, but like Disney was literally like, well, we are launching Hulu Plus, therefore this would interfere with that. It's like, no, it wouldn't. No. But like when you're in a very large corporation and you're like some subdivision of a subdivision of a subdivision, it's not run very efficiently. Disney is not one of these cultures like a friend who works for Amazon. Like Amazon will micromanage everything. It can be good or bad in different ways, but like Disney is all about scale, 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 you know, the National Football League and theme parks and nine figure budget movies. And if you're like a little tiny barnacle on the Disney whale, then you'll just get ignored till the politics change and they have to cut staff. And we're this division that no one ever even tried to make a profit with, although I think we could have. And of course, at some point you get.
So I guess going back to the larger question of, you know, individual companies are one thing, but is the mediascape in general, and I'm not being flip here, you know, is it an absolute loss when, you know, the LA Times shrinks? Are you confident that new things will crop up that will perform either the same function or the function as it needs to be done now rather than what a daily newspaper did in 1970 or 1980.
Look, I think there are different. I mean, it's weird because you do have like Substack, I think, is great, and you do have, you know, social media has, although complicated, democratized things in a lot of ways. So it's the upper middle class. Like a lot of things, has gotten quite squeezed. You know, I mean, I think things like local reporting, the fact that like the very obvious and kind of comical, like George Santos' story, didn't get a lot of pickup, for example. Like things like that are going by the wayside a bit. I think we're just going to have like a few more blind spots. Like, look, is it like in my list of like the 10 biggest problems in America right now? No. Right? Top 25? Okay, maybe. Yeah. I think it's bad, but like I don't think, look, people have a desire to express themselves. There are some outlets like the New York Times that are still doing very well.
So a bigger problem might be, you wrote recently in an essay, and the title kind of explains what it's about, and I'd like your comment on it. Free speech is in trouble. Young liberals are abandoning it, and other groups are too comfortable with tit-for-tat hypocrisy. This was from November.
Yeah.
Why are young liberals abandoning free speech?
I mean, I think people should realize that, like, America is still in the whole history of the world. What I would call enlightenment liberalism, these are still, like, relatively new ideas, you know? They've been with us for a few centuries and not more than that. And in some ways they're kind of like counterintuitive ideas. The notion that, if we actually kind of like, are a little bit more laissez-faire and let people do what they want, then actually the free hand of the market, invisible hand will generate more wealth and we'll all be collectively better off. Right. It kind of sounds too good to be true, except it mostly is true. Right.
Right.
Empirically over a long period of time. But you know, when you have, there are a couple of things. One, which is relevant to my book, is that for the first time in maybe history, the younger generation is more risk averse than older people, right? They're having less sex. They're doing fewer drugs. Those can be good or bad. I don't know, right?
It's so bad they're having less sex than Joe Biden.
Right? He apparently is doing quite well.
He was in the headlines for that, which is like, hey.
Can you imagine like the PR person?
And you wonder why newspapers
like,
are dying, right?
They're workshopping that comment for
Look,
I am not somebody who says that there are never any tangible harms from controversial speech. I mean, look at Salman Rushdie or something like that, right? I mean, free speech can like actually have effects. It's a powerful thing. But if you're so risk averse, you just want to maintain harmony, and that I think that's part of it, right? Yeah. And also, like, you know, these are not people that grew up with the memory of the Cold War, or certainly not of World War II, right?
Or kind of censorship, mass censorship, when you think back to the idea that books like Lady Chatterley's Lover or Tropic of Cancer, Ulysses, really weren't legally published in America until the late 50s, early 60s.
Yeah, or even things, if you're like 23 or something, even dumb stuff like the Dixie Chicks in, in the Bush years, right? People even forget about that kind of thing.
Right. Why do you think then other people, you know, not woke progressives, but then, you know, why are conservatives who constantly talk about the Constitution, or perhaps even libertarians in certain circumstances are like, yeah, well, let's point out the people, or let's be hypocritical in order to, you know, own the libs. What's going on there?
One of the universal truths about everything in life is that if you have a longer time horizon, you almost always benefit from that. People are trying to win the argument to feel satisfaction in that immediate moment, that hour, right? To win the debate. And they think I'll get into the left on things, not the left, actually, it's kind of more kind of center left partisan Democrats about Biden's age. And they kind of think, well, if I can dunk on Nate Silver about Biden's age, then I'll win the argument. Right. But like the problem is, it's not an argument between you or me. 70% of the American electorate thinks Biden is too old. Very reasonably so, I might add. I mean, I think anyone, 80 is just above a threshold that I think anyone should be commander in chief. But like they're trying to like win the argument and not win the war
So this might be an impossible question to answer. It's kind of a chicken or egg thing. But are we more talking about like present short-term things? Because that's the infrastructure, you know, that's social media, that's the way media, cable news operates now. Or have we conjured those things in order to win quick arguments in the idea that that will transform society?
It's probably, it's three things, right? It's partly human nature, partly the nature of modern media, and partly the fact that, again, people are not in politics for truth-seeking reasons, right? Hmm. They're in politics to win partisan arguments, basically, and to enforce orthodoxy, because you have two parties that, again, are taking like this multidimensional, you know, 20-dimensional space and trying to like collapse it all down into two coalitions that may not actually have all that much in common if you start to pick apart differences. And you need kind of useful idiots to like to enforce those hierarchies.
Before we continue with today's Reason interview, I want to talk to you about our sponsor for this episode, BetterHelp Online Therapy. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P. If you're having any sort of trouble in your life, you might benefit from therapy. And I want to tell you that BetterHelp is a great service, whether you're feeling anxious, depressed, or just like you're not the best version of yourself. BetterHelp is entirely online. It's designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. All you have to do is fill out a brief questionnaire. You'll get matched to a licensed therapist. You can switch therapists anytime for no additional charge. I know it's a great service because I used it myself for about 2 years, and it really made a difference in my life. So visit betterhelp.com/TRI today. You'll get 10% off your first month. The TRI stands for The Reason Interview. Make sure to get that discount on your first month. Go to betterhelp.com/TRI. And now back to The Reason Interview.
So I guess, why are you different? I mean, your entire career, going back to your work, you know, at Baseball Prospectus and elsewhere, you were more data driven, and it's, we don't want to get into follow the science, you know, data will tell you whatever you need it to tell you, right?
Yes.
But, you know, why aren't there more journalists like you that are like, you know what, let's actually try and ascertain reality and then tease out trends and meaning, as opposed to I'm coming in and I'm just going to bulldoze things into what I want it to be.
No, it's funny because, you know, now I feel like I'm more of a traditionalist. You know, when I went to the New York Times in 2010, they were very concerned that I had kind of publicly said that I had I said I had voted for Obama in 2008, right? Which I thought was just a matter of like basic transparency. I would make the same vote again, to be sure. But that was a big problem that I had even been open about my kind of like political views at all, where it comes full circle now, where if you don't kind of express your view on every issue, then you're seen as being suspect potentially. But look, the world is dynamic, and so it's possible to overcorrect. I think there was or is truth in the kind of left critique of like both sides journalism. Mm-hmm. The truth is certainly not always, especially if you're a libertarian, right? It's not just somewhere in the middle. You people aren't centrist, right? It's a different dimension, and you have, you know,
it's a very different dimension that some people will claim doesn't even really exist. So you certainly can't find it on any map, right? It's
And look, I think even some of the more like woke version of it, like obviously I do think that like it's to some approximation true that like, yeah, like white men have a lot of power in media. And like, of course, it's absolutely true. Right. But when you don't give people credit for being willing to adapt, if you read the New York Times today and compare it to 2013 or something, it's a vastly different paper now. And like, and so you have to adjust to that moving target and not to the same standard. Right. And give people credit for being, and this is like part of why I like, I guess, the free market, right? Is it gives people credit for being intelligent and like within their domain, like relatively rational. It's not like, oh, I'm the only smart person in the room. It's a little bit like with, to bounce around a bit, a little bit with like kind of some of the COVID stuff on like the early dialogue about masks, where Fauci is like, okay, well, later on we're gonna tell people masks are worthwhile, but let's kind of say they don't really do anything. We need them for like essential workers, right? And people don't really notice that we're kind of telling a good, noble lie. Like, that shows contempt for people. And if you play poker, then you know that kind of like, although bluffing is a part of poker, you know that if you're inconsistent, that you're allowing yourself to be exploited by your opponent, right? Your opponent's smart. If you were only playing a certain kind of hand a certain way with a bluff or with a strong hand, then you will be exploited by your opponent. As opposed to treating them as intelligent and adaptable and more sophisticated, like I think you should treat people as being intelligent. It's a much more robust strategy than assuming that you're the only kind of like that you're the only kind of worthwhile and smart people in the room.
Very quickly, talk about your book On the Edge. It comes out in August. What's the précis of it?
So the book is called On the Edge. It's a book about gambling and risk. It covers a lot of territory. So it kind of starts out, it kind of follows my journey where, like, before I ever covered politics, I played poker online for a period of time in the mid-2000s. So it kind of starts out in the poker world.
What was your best year in poker? How much did you make?
A couple hundred thousand or something? Yeah. Okay. No, there was a time when it was
how
easy.
Much did you lose, I guess, you also did that?
That's
right?
Net. Yeah. Oh, yeah. You can, like, do funny things with, like, your gross poker income. That's net.
Why did you stop that?
Because the government passed a law called the UIGEA, something Gaming Enforcement Act, right? Which is kind of what piqued my interest in politics. It was, like, tucked into some unrelated security legislation at the end of 2006. I wanted the bastards who passed legislation, who are mostly Republicans, to lose, and they did. Democrats had a good midterm in 2016, or 2006, rather. Right. And I'm like, okay, well, they fucking took away my livelihood, so what am I going to do now, right? And I kind of wound up starting to write about politics.
And here you are simping for Trump. So
Thanks.
What a world. What a strange world, bud. So On the Edge, though, you did a phenomenal amount of interviews and research for this. So can you kind of talk a little bit about the scope of that?
Yeah, so it starts out in, like, poker and sports betting, but it gets into areas like venture capital, gets into crypto. I talked to our friend Sam Bankman-Fried quite a bit, gets into effective altruism, gets into a lot of the AI stuff. It's a fundamental book about a certain type of nerd, right? A certain type of very competitive analytical nerd, because these people are kind of like...
So it's an autobiography.
Okay, well, sort of.
Right?
Yeah,
no, it's like I don't memoir. Say that meanly. I'm saying, like...
But no, like, there's like not a good term for this type, but they're kind of like actually taking over the world in a lot of ways, right? They're the ones who run tech and finance. Tech and finance are eating the world, right? So it's a tour, an insider's tour about how people like that think. There were like 200 interviews. I mean, I did like a lot of trips to Vegas, which was fun. But you're trying to like immerse people in the topic and give people a front row seat. And also, like, you know, I have, like, I'm not like a big network access guy, right? But I'm flattering myself here. Because I think I am fair, I think people will talk to me that would not talk to other people, right? Like, I am talking to, like, some of the top Silicon Valley VCs on their own terms in unguarded ways, because, like, I'm not coming in with, like, with an agenda apart from, like, trying to understand them. And look, the book is very critical of some things, including people like Silicon Valley, right? But I think it's, like, fair. It didn't, like, preconceive what it wanted to say before I actually did the reporting, the interviewing. And I think that will be reflected in the work.
Do you, I guess, to go back to Hayek, and my favorite work by Hayek is The Counter-Revolution of Science, Studies in the Abuses, on the Abuse of Reason. And he worried that what happened in the French Enlightenment, or what he considered the French Enlightenment, was that everything got too mathematized, and that ultimately people were just data points in other people's grand theories or formulas, and you erase them if they you know mess up your equation.
Yeah,
are we too quantified in this world? You know, in the way that you're talking about, all of the big industries seem to be being run, you know, by quants of one sort or another.
I mean, there are a few dimensions of this, right? One is like the dubious claims to have scientific authority and say, oh, we are just doing what the data tells us. You saw this during like COVID and whatnot. You see this with the concept of misinformation, which is often entirely subjective, right? That's one dimension. Look, I mean, the book also gets into utilitarianism a little bit and effective altruism, where they try to quantify everything and you run into problems with that, right? First of all, like, I actually build models for a living, right? Like, I built sports models and election models, tried to bet on them myself, and in a sense, like, you know, a game theory, a poker strategy is kind of a model, right? Mm-hmm. Like, building a model is pretty hard. There are lots of ways to screw up. There are lots of omitted variable biases. And, like, it like might be another overcorrection thing where, like, yeah, like 20 years ago, the world needed to become more data driven. Now it's become like a little bit of a, you know, when you have a hammer, everything looks like a nail kind of thing problem a little bit.
Final question before we go to the audience is, I was looking up the Mets odds of making the playoffs this year. And according to Pacoda, which is a system that you created, right?
Yeah, but it's been inherited by other people. Yeah.
Yes, but it was coming in that they have like a 49% chance of making the playoffs this year. Does that sound about right?
That sounds reasonable. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. All right. So, so they're not going to.
Right. I mean, you know, the Mets can't be explained by any rational principle.
Yeah. Okay. Fair enough. Okay. Well, let's open it up to questions. I'm sorry. We're going.
Nate, I have a. Can I ask a two-part question, Nick? Is that permissible?
You can ask a two-part question.
Okay. If you were to make a market based on what we know about COVID and the likelihood of COVID being bioengineered and leaked from a lab versus natural origin, what would you? How would you assess that?
So there are there are prediction markets, right? I think unlike manifest or manifold, rather, it's like 77% lab leak, 23% natural origin, which to me seems about right. Right. I try to maintain some like epistemic humility on this, but it's almost like an Occam's razor kind of thing where, look, if you have proposals to do gain of function research on coronaviruses where you insert like a furin cleavage site, and then it turns out that exact thing happened to happen in a city where they have one of the world's leading coronavirus laboratories. Like it's like the John Stewart thing about Hershey's and chocolate. Like that's actually very good Bayesian reasoning, right? It's very weird that it emerged in Wuhan, which is not a center for actual like bat coronaviruses and things like that, right? It's very weird that it emerged there. Like that's a very powerful prior. And you know, look, you can get into more detail also about the degree of obfuscation. Yeah, thank you, Nick. You know, it's also a little bit of like if you're a baseball fan, you learn to like watch the outfielders and not the ball if you know if it's going to be a home run or not, right? You know, the way people seem very afraid to have a true like debate on this issue. I mean, look, this is like one of those issues that like that I found like a little bit radicalizing. Again, I don't know what happened for sure, right? I think it's 75-25 or 80-20, which is a very, very, very long way from like 99-1 or 100-0. But the fact that you had these obviously bullshit papers published in like the best, most prestigious scientific journals, and like even now people can't quite admit to it. They're kind of like, well, weren't we a little tired of the COVID stuff, right? Can't we just move on? Mm-hmm. Like, that's like deeply, you know, only 8 million people died, right? It's not
do
that
you,
bad.
Do you think that is part of the breakdown on the left side of the political spectrum as well, that you know, there was a lot being shoved down people's throats that was obviously false.
It's easier to lie with lies of omission, right? Like even something like this, like Google Gemini super woke AI that I wrote about the other day. Yeah. You know, the New York Times, the big like tech publications were not doing the best work on this. It was all on X, Twitter, and Substack. You know, I don't think the New York Times publishes a lot of things that are false, but you know, what they kind of sink their teeth into or not is often quite, you know, reveals a lot of bias, right?
It was, you know, and your piece on that is fantastic. I despite the name Silver Bulletin, I highly recommend a Substack. But, you know, you had a lot of fun with the fact that queries saying, you know, show me a German soldier in 1943 and it would be a black person, an African-American. And it reminded me of when, you know, Judas got cast in Jesus Christ Superstar. And it's like, Judas, it's the black guy. And it's like, it's the wrong kind of progress, right? That and inclusion, it seems.
Well, no, look, I actually think that, like, I kind of wish there were better, like, left-wing critiques of AI stuff, too, right? This is a case where, like, corporations have a lot of power to shape reality, right? Like to me, it's actually kind of worrying that like this is not a good profit maximizing decision for Google.
There are problems with profit
maximization, but like at least it's kind of predictable. Whereas how did a company this large produce such a terrible product? It's kind of the business story of like the decade, if not the century, and the fact that you don't have like every like tech reporter slobbering over it because the valence is kind of very vaguely right-leaning.
Yeah, and you point out at the end that this, it's not like this came out by accident. This actually reveals something deep about the ethos at work in Google.
Yeah, there are similar things if you look at not just the image generation, but the text generation. There are similar things if you looked at Google image search, for example, where like Google, which kind of in its IPO pledged to be unbiased and impartial and objective. By the way, now doesn't pledge that anymore, right? They are honest about it, but like they're putting a really heavy finger on the scale. I mean, look, I mean, my notes before I came here, I'm reading Google Docs on my Android phone, right? Yeah. These companies have a lot of power, and if they're kind of using it to facilitate political objectives, I mean, not that you won't also have problems with people being manipulated by algorithms, like that's a valid concern, but that ought to be like, you know, I'm not a big like congressional hearings kind of guy, mm-hmm. right? But like, that's the kind of thing you probably should have a hearing about is like, you know, are AI labs like inserting politics into supposedly objective output?
I would like to see that done in the marketplace of ideas. But point taken, Jonathan. Okay, next.
I feel like one of the subtly profound things Substack has done is show us what different pundits are worth in like a pure willingness to pay sense. So like it turned out Andrew Sullivan and Matt Taibbi and Iglesias, and I'm sure you like are all worth many times more what they made when they were in mainstream legacy media. What do you think that's done to the media ecosystem?
Yeah, look, I mean, I have mixed feelings about it because on the one hand, like, yeah, I'm probably on that part of the hockey stick where you benefit from that net. And also I do the type of content that like, I think is good for a subscriber newsletter. Look, it's going to cause problems for many publications where, you know, the New York Times had like an implicit kind of like pay cap and like, you know, not me, maybe in a couple of years, right? But like an Andrew Sullivan would like, or Matt Taibbi would like break that pay cap substantially. And yet that would subsidize other parts of the paper. So look, it's democratizing. It's basically good, right? It's democratizing and liberalizing. And I'm in favor of people kind of achieving, their marginal revenue product and capturing that as opposed to some big corporation. But it is going to be tough for, I think, again, like the middle ground of journalism, right? Like I like the Atlantic, right? But like someone like that has like a lot of like ideas people, is competing very directly with like the Substacks of the world. I also worry a little bit about like, you know, there have not been that many new stars on Substack, right? It's kind of like people who are, you know, early middle age to late middle age who have an established brand and like have an audience with them. I worry about not having creative kind of young blood in journalism.
Farm team. You know, what's interesting too is Substack might be, you know, as people get spread out more and more, the editor function or the curation function, you know, there's a value to that. And that's what The Times does. That's what Atlantic does. That's what all magazines do on some level. It'll be interesting to see, you know, and that might actually be the model that the free press is doing, where it's curation. It's a couple of stars, but it's mostly, you know, an older model.
Substack's got, I mean, for a while they were providing editing services. They've kind of pulled back from that and had these internal squabbles, obviously, about like, are we just kind of like a platform? Are we a publisher? Are we somewhere in between? It is nice to have actual editing, right? For the Substack, I don't. For my book, I have like a terrific editor and a terrific research assistant, a terrific like fact checker, right? And you go through like four or five rounds of each draft and like, that's a great process. I mean, you can't do that for every Substack post exactly, but like, I hope editors are still respected and valued, right? I don't think that the AIs have very good editorial judgment, right? Maybe OpenAI should hire a bunch of ex-journalists. I'm kind of half serious about that.
That's interesting. Okay, next question.
Hi, Nate. I know you've built a career out of constructing models that predict election outcomes, but how would you adjust your models and your assumptions, given that there have been so many changes in the way that votes are collected with mail-in voting? And also, how would you adjust for, you know, the variables that have to do with information suppression and the we've seen with the Twitter files, you know, it's very possible for, you know, purveyors of information to put their thumbs on the scale. How would you adjust your models and assumptions, you know, for those types of changes?
I mean, with an election model, in some sense, you're trying to keep it simple, right? And not adjust for too much. The reason being that we only have a sample of like 14 elections with any meaningful amount of polling data. And if you have a sample of 14 elections, then there's not that much you can do with it apart from kind of take a simple model and say, okay, empirically, how accurate are the polls? If Biden is ahead by 3 points in Pennsylvania on October 15th, you know, how often does he win Pennsylvania, and how correlated is Pennsylvania with Michigan and Wisconsin, right? Like, that's like a tractable problem where you don't have to go to like first principles to think about, like, is public opinion being measured accurately? I'm not a pollster. Pollsters have a lot of challenges. Most people don't answer polls anymore. It's a big stretch to assume that the people who do are representative of the people who vote, right? I mean, they are a self-selected, often very highly educated sample of people that is not representative. What pollsters have figured out is that you have to like apply a lot of massaging and secret sauce. And they do have good incentives to like get accurate answers, more or less pollsters do. But no, look, I'm trying to keep the model simple and kind of quantify how much error there is in the polling, which is actually a fair bit. You know, some years have been better than others. 2022 was actually a pretty good year for the polls. 2020 was a disaster, obviously. But that's why there are big probabilities and uncertainties around even like a seemingly not that close election.
What, as we go to the next question, what's the biggest prediction that you've screwed up or you got wrong?
Well, my answer is different than other people. Like, so in 2016, our model had Trump with like a 29% chance of winning, and the consensus, the betting markets were 15%, right? So to me, as someone who has gambled for a living at times, including making sports bets, right, to me, that's a great forecast because it means you would bet actually at Trump on 6-to-1 odds when the odds should be 2.5-to-1, right, and make a killing in expected value terms in that respect, right? And like, that's how I think about the world. I came into politics, the last thing I'd done before that was as a professional poker player, right? Most people think thing with under 50% chance happened, you're a fucking idiot, Nate Silver, right? But like that's not how I think about the world. And like again, I'm the one who actually is like made a living kind of betting on making forecasts and predictions, right? And so like, but no, the unambiguous mistake we made, or I made, was in 2016, we didn't have a model for this. It's just kind of my mistake as like a pundit, whatever you want to call me, was being dismissive of Trump's chances to win the nomination in 2016. When ironically, Trump had led in the polls almost the whole way, right? He came down the escalators at Trump Tower, was treated as a joke, got on TV a lot, criticized John McCain for being injured in war, right? And it kind of just took off. And people like me were very stubborn until pretty late in the game, for saying, oh, it's just name recognition. No, it's not real, right? It's not going to settle in. I think, you know, like in some ways, I mean, that was a huge mistake, obviously, on my part. Yeah.
I'd like to ask you about X. Last year, you had this, it was a great piece that you had in Substack, and then you did a thread on X about the difference between blue states and red states in COVID deaths. And when you came out with that, these grenades started coming in, and they were just bizarre. The responses that you got really seemed to have nothing to do with what you were talking about. And I know that you've been very generous about saying, well, X is a great, you know, it's a great forum. But it's also a cesspool. And it seems like that was an example of how X can be super cesspool-y. So if you just comment on that. How do we drain that swamp?
I mean, look, X is still a cesspool. It's a little bit more of a pluralistic cesspool now, right? Whereas, like, before there was a certain, not quite even center left, but, like, progressive orthodoxy that if you violated it, that you would get totally piled on. I mean, I think me and Maggie Haberman are, like, tied for the most times being a trending topic on Twitter among journalists, right? Because, I mean, I'm not in the same bucket as Maggie, obviously, right? But she is reporting the best of her ability, right? I'm just trying to, like, get at the truth. And, like, and people assume we're supposed to be, like, the people who help Democrats win. Like, it's not my function as a journalist, right? I hate that idea of, like, being in line with one party. I think Elon has, like, democratized it a bit and made that one faction less dominant. But, yeah, look, I mean, the Twitter is set up for dunking and for groupthink in a lot of ways, right? It's like a medium that runs very hot in like the Marshall McLuhan sense of the term, right? Where you feel this rage and urge to go into into combat. I mean, it's very addictive, right? I mean, it's still true that like the first thing I do every morning is check Twitter. It's extremely engaging. And it's kind of like a very lowercase L libertarian adjacent person. Like, I'm not sure how I feel about, like, should we like regulate this tech company, right? Where people voluntarily are opting in to kind of use Twitter. But like, look, if we found out that like social media has caused substantial disutility in the world, I mean, I think there's decent evidence about this, right? You know, adding to polarization, adding to maybe depression in some ways, incentivizing kind of short-term equilibria instead of kind of long-term good. It is a problem for sure.
Yes. I met someone 3 weeks ago, the first person I've met in person who believed that the NFL was purposely throwing the games to benefit Taylor Swift and maybe Joe Biden. And this person was also someone who's played in the World Series of Poker. And I thought, as someone who was had done professional gambling, she would understand how expensive it would be to throw Super Bowl games and all the playoff games. But is there something in the mind of a professional poker player that would lead you to be more conspiratorial?
So if you're a pro poker player, then you probably have very good quantitative skills and at least decent people skills. Poker is in part a people game, right? You can be strange, but you have to have like some intuition for how people behave. If you have those skills, you can go make a fucking like fortune working for a hedge fund or something. So the fact that people pick poker means that they are lone wolves, right? That they do feel they are a little bit anti-authoritarian. I mean, hey, you know, like how like Thomas Friedman gets like every opinion from like a taxi driver or an Uber driver, right? There's a little bit of that at poker. It's very diverse politically, right? You'll meet socialists, you'll meet libertarians, you'll meet rational center-left people, you'll meet cranks, right? So it's good to like get kind of a cross section of male public opinion. It is very male, like 97%. But no, look, I mean, look, I think there's ample evidence that like intel, like look at like the Mensa people, right? They often have like crazy conspiratorial things they believe, and like in some ways, smart people are better at rationalization and can fall for conspiracy theories and can be gullible in certain ways. And so, no, it doesn't surprise me like that. Yeah, obviously some poker players are crazy. I'd rather have that person at my table than someone who doesn't think that the NFL rigged the Super Bowl, right? but you get all comers in poker for sure.
So are you saying the Super Bowl was rigged?
I mean, look, I had a little money on the Chiefs is all I'll say.
Okay. All right, and you got that in an envelope that came 2 weeks before the game was played.
Just a little.
Fair enough.
Little bump up.
Final question.
Well, it's another gambling question. All right. And this issue kind of splits conservatives and libertarians. We're a gambling crazy country now. Sports betting, everything, and under the sun. Do you have a view about that? It's a regressive tax, demonstrably. Is it a good thing that we've turned those bounds loose?
I mean, the irony is that the worst forms of gambling are prey on the lower working class, right? Like the lottery takes 50% of every bet that you make on average in different states, right? Like DraftKings takes 4.5%. You know, at the blackjack table, they take 1% if you play correctly. So there are a couple things. Like one is like, look, the centrist solution is to probably like, is to ban, I mean, I'm not advocating for this. I'm saying like, if you want to carve out like a middle ground, it's to differentiate more different forms of gambling, right? Like slot machines are much more addictive than table games like blackjack or like poker, and explicitly use algorithms to try to like get people to like get hooked on the slot machine and pay more. There's a good book called, Addiction by Design by Natasha Schull, who's an NYU anthropologist, who is like not a prude. She's fun, right? But like she went and did like a thesis in Las Vegas and like actually talked to like problem gamblers and found that some of them actually don't want to win. This is one of the scariest things I learned when writing the book, is that like if you are like a slot machine addict, you want to get into like a machine zone, what she calls like the machine zone, kind of a flow state where you're just kind of playing the machine. You're almost like working. You're undisturbed by the problems outside the world.
William Bennett did this.
Yeah.
Former Department of Drug Czar and Education
Secretary. Yeah. And if you win a slot jackpot, I've won video poker jackpots once, right? Like literally sirens go off and lights flash. The spotlight's kind of literally on you. It's very disruptive, right? So they just want to play. They don't care about winning. They kind of know on one hand that like it probably is like a negative expected value gamble, but they're so kind of, they want to escape from the problems of the world. And like, I don't know, slot machines are pretty bad, right?
But they're better than lotteries and scratch-off tickets, right?
Oh, which yeah, are lotteries are
vastly more popular when it comes to actual dollars bet.
Yeah, and by the way, like if you're going to have...
So shouldn't, I mean, wouldn't the elegant solution if we want to reduce gambling is get rid of scratch-off tickets that are run by the state?
For sure, like no state that has scratch-off tickets has any business talking to anybody about any other form of gambling, right? Like again, like, that's very manipulative. Like I have friends who like do marketing for like the New York Lottery. They have a good budget. They do funny ads, right? But you know, it's a huge house cut, 50% that's being taken. Most from people who like probably shouldn't be gambling very much, right? Where if you go to like the Aria or the Wynn in Las Vegas, I mean, look, the high-end casinos, people are having a good time, right? Like that to me seems like a fair arm's length transaction where yeah, there are some problematic customers, but like, you're having a fun time. You're spending a lot of money, right? Sometimes you win. It's a nice experience. The lower rung casinos, there are some that are kitschy and fun, right? You know, go to the El Cortez downtown in Vegas. It's a fun place to hang out, but it can get pretty depressing. And like, it's preying on people who I think are often being manipulated by false beliefs about how probability works.
So I guess to close things down, let's bring it back to this question of kind of enlightenment values and enlightenment liberalism, which is on a profound level is predicated on the idea that we can all mostly be autonomous, that we deserve the right to have the freedom to make choices in our life, to live the way we want, to make money the way we want, you know, marry who we want, eat what we want, et cetera. Do you feel like... do you feel like that's what's being tested now in the way that people talk about things? Are we in a good place for, you know, people taking control of their lives as opposed to kind of running to a conspiracy theory on the right or the left or wherever?
I mean, maybe my view is darker, which I think the lessons are that we shouldn't trust groups to make decisions, or we shouldn't trust, let me take that back, right? We should be wary of like kind of like the expert class who do not have local knowledge, who do not have correct incentives, right? And that in the market, at least, you kind of have trial and error, and there are lots and lots and lots of bad ideas, but you have some mechanism for sorting out in the long run the good ideas from the bad ones, right? Something like AI is a little scary in that way, because like with AI, it's kind of inherently a winner take most field where you need lots and lots and lots of computing power. It's probably going to be, you know, Google and OpenAI and Microsoft and the Chinese government, maybe the Department of Defense or whatever, I don't know, right? But like to have like a hegemonic world of like five or six players is I think quite scary, right? And you don't have to be like Elizabeth Warren to be worried about the fact that like, I don't care per se about the concentration of wealth, right? I maybe care about the concentration of power. And when you have like more and more people who are more powerful than entire countries, like I'm not sure that's kind of great for kind of even kind of lowercase L free market liberalism, yeah. Right?
Do you, in the end though, do you agree that it's probably better to have that than to have five Elizabeth Warrens dictating the shapes of market?
Yeah, no, it's a much more robust failure mode, yeah. Right? It's like the whole kind of Churchillian, you know, democracy is the best, worst idea.
Right.
Why am I butchering this, right? The worst system, except for all the other systems.
I hope we're talking
basically
about Ward Churchill, right?
Churchill.
He's the Churchill I stand.
Exactly, yeah.
But,
no. But it's a robust failure mode, and like we're having a lot of failures now, and yet I guess the country's kind of trudging along. We'll see. We'll see.
Forward into failure in the future. I want to thank Nate Silver for talking to Reason.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You can sign up for our other podcast series, including the Reason Roundtable, the SoHo Forum debates, Just Asking Questions, Why We Can't Have Nice Things, and even the Best of Reason, where a robotic AI voice trained on Catherine Mangu Ward's vocal utterances reads new great stories from Reason. So go to reason.com/podcasts and sign up, subscribe to all of them. Thanks for listening.